Anyway, my name is Art Vanek. I'm from Southern California, and I'm otherwise known on the internet by certain people as a member of the vast counterculture movement. That being said, I've been a Southern California resident for 40 plus years. I'm originally from Chicago. My wife, Cheryl, is here with me today. Couldn't have made this book without her. My co-authors and I have been at this since 1974. Well, let me clarify. We've been on the research end of it, on and off, since 1974. One of the reasons it took so long is we all have day jobs. You know, we had to use the day jobs to finance something. But it's been an incredibly fascinating journey of discovery. Two things pretty much led me to join up with my two co-authors. One of them was an experience I had in 1965 on a church temple tour over here, just up the street. My mother and I were about to go on the tour, and as the fellow was talking of extolling the virtues of Joseph Smith, my mom unleashed a tirade that almost got us thrown out of the place. I had no idea about Mormonism at all at that time. Fast forward about 9 years, I meet my two co-authors. We're at a party, and they asked me what I know about the Book of Mormon. Joseph Smith wrote it, and they said, no. Pauling wrote it, as a romantic Indian. I was hooked. We've been at this, like I said, for about 33 years. We've come out with three different publications on the subject, the first one in 1977, and our current one that came out 2 years ago through the Concordia Publishing.
Luck individual, he was born in 1761 in Connecticut. He was a Revolutionary War veteran. He went to Dartmouth, graduated from there. He was in the Congregationalist clergy for a while. He was in a variety of jobs, but he was never in any one of them for any particular length of time, because the poor man had just about the poorest health of any individual that I've ever read about. He'd be at one job for about a year, and his health would act up and gone. He worked with his brothers in a general store. Health act up, onto something else. Real estate speculation, an iron forge, you name it, all sorts of different things. Till toward the very end of his life, he said, I've got to do something. I'm financially in the depths of despair. My health is going. I've got to do something to provide a financial legacy for my family. I'm an educated man. I've explored the Indian burial mounds all over the territory. I'll write a book. And so around 1809, 1810, he starts on the first of his two major manuscripts called Manuscript Story. Well, he gets through about 175 pages of it, and he's gradually losing interest. And so he starts his second work called Manuscript Found. And this thing, I mean, he just really put every effort he could into it. And it turned into this lengthy Elizabethan English-styled romantic epic about the ancient inhabitants of the United States, namely the American Indians, and how they were somehow descended from the lost tribes of Israel. Does that ring a bell anywhere? Around 1814, he moves to Pittsburgh, and with the express purpose of seeking out a publisher. He finds one in the R&J Patterson print shop. He meets with the Pattersons. They tell him, yeah, we like your book, but we're not so sure how it's going to sell, so we need you to provide some security money to cover the cost of printing, just in case nobody buys the thing. One of the identifying features of Manuscript Found was that it had so many instances and variations of the phrase, it came to pass, that Spalding's neighbors and especially his family nicknamed him Old Come to Pass. And as a matter of fact, it had something like 160 times, well, as you know, in the 1830 edition of the Book of Mormon, that edition has something like 150 times the instances of that phrase than the entire King James Bible, okay? Well, anyway, so Spalding has his manuscript there, and he's ready to raise the money, but once again, his health fails him, this time for good. He dies without being able to raise the money, which brings us to the next point, the Spalding authorship claims. You know, this goes under a variety of names. We've recently been calling it the Spalding authorship claims. It's also called the Spalding theory, the Spalding-Rigdon theory. There's the debunked theory, depending on who you talk to out there. In brief, it all obviously revolves around manuscript found. Sometime around 1814, Spalding and his wife suspected Sidney Rigdon of stealing the manuscript out of the Patterson print shop. Don't know why he would do that, but in any case, they suspected him of the theft because the manuscript did, in fact, disappear for a while, not returning until after Spalding had passed away. Well, Rigdon takes the manuscript. A few years later, meets Oliver Cowdery, who then takes him to Joseph Smith. The three of them look at the book. It's just what Joseph Smith needs, according to his occult mentor, Lumen Walters, who tells him you'll never be a real prophet till you have a book. Sidney Rigdon is looking for a way to make a religious name for himself. He had been a Baptist preacher. He got thrown out of the Baptist organization for controversial doctrine. He then joined the Campbellites. And just when he thought he was in line to succeed Campbell at the head of the Campbellites, Campbell says, no, my son's going to do it. See ya. So he had envisioned himself as kind of a New World Apostle Paul, but he had no vehicle for it. With Spalding's manuscript, he would finally have that vehicle. Now, of Rigdon, Cowdery, and Smith, about the only one who even came close to being a true believer, if you will, was Oliver Cowdery. He was absolutely bowled over by the religious fervor of Sidney Rigdon and, of course, the hucksterism of Joseph Smith. And so you have Rigdon providing the religious content for the Book of Mormon, you have Joseph Smith selling it, and you have Oliver Cowdery serving as the pre-press consultant and the guy who works with, E.B. Grandin, to actually publish the book. Okay, the silhouettes of Solomon and Matilda Spalding, they didn't have photographs back then, so this was the closest you'll ever see to a wedding photo. These two sterling individuals in this photograph, the one on the left is Bill Moore, our book's editor. That's his brother, and the rock formation in the background is an actual ancient Indian burial mound from just outside of Pittsburgh. They decided to try and go find some of these things and you know, see what they actually looked like. So it's not the best picture in the world, but it's the only one I've got so far. Okay, on the left you have Spalding's last home in Amity, which that's the city where he died, and then this is beautiful downtown Amity on the right. I believe the pictures were taken from around the turn of the century, and I have some current color photographs of the city of Amity, and there are maybe three more homes, okay, and I think a gas station just off this way. The wagon might still be there. As you can imagine, with something like this, the church down the street wasn't too happy with it. And so over the years, in fact, the Spalding authorship claims actually predate the Book of Mormon, because back in 1814, as I told you earlier, both Solomon and his wife accused Sidney Rigdon of taking the manuscript. So the statement here that a man by the name of Hurlbut started the whole thing, this actually originates with an accusation by a guy named Benjamin Winchester, who wrote some diatribe in 1840. And anyway, Winchester is the last person to throw stones at anyone, as far as we're concerned. Second one, no Rigdon in Pittsburgh before 1822. Obviously, if they can prove that there was no Rigdon around the time that Spalding and his manuscript was there, it's a slam dunk. Only one manuscript. It has been claimed over and over and over by not just the people down the street, but a lot of what we call Smith-only authorship folks, that there was and is only one manuscript, Spalding's manuscript story. And since manuscript story doesn't really resemble the Book of Mormon, they say that all this nonsense about a second manuscript is just that, just nonsense. Finally, they claim that Rigdon didn't know Smith before 1830. Well, obviously, if he didn't know him before 1830, he couldn't have helped work on Spalding's manuscript, so there you have it. And here we have the big trio, Sidney Rigdon, Oliver Cowdery, and Joseph Smith. There they are. This is a photograph of a couple of the pages from Spalding's manuscript story. About 31, 32 years ago, we had the opportunity to go back to Oberlin College and photograph several samples of manuscript story because we used it as part of our first book. So I wanted to show this to you so you can see definitely that manuscript story exists. Okay, obviously we don't agree that Hurlbut started the Spalding authorship claims. He was pretty much just the first one to launch a serious investigation of it. There are actually newspaper articles dating back to 1830, which is about 3-4 years before Hurlbut even was commissioned by a group of people to look into it, linking Spalding and his manuscript found with the Book of Mormon. And here we have the J of R&J Patterson, Joseph Patterson. And this man here, Eber Howe, he published the first significant book that mentions the Spalding authorship claims. And it was called Mormonism Unveiled, and it came out in 1834. This lovely lady is Matilda McKinstry, Solomon Spalding's daughter. And this was one of her happier moments. This is the Pittsburgh Commonwealth newspaper. We discovered this in 1995, and it turned around and gave new life into the whole Spalding authorship claims theory, whatever you want to call it. And I will show you that in just a minute. As I said earlier, Spalding and his wife accused Rigdon of stealing the manuscript as early as 1814. Just so happened, Rigdon had a tannery in the Pittsburgh area during the years 1814 to 1818, and he supplied the printer at the Patterson Print Shop with leather book bindings. So it kind of puts a whole damper on the claim that Rigdon wasn't there before 1822. Then we also have Joseph Miller's testimony. He claimed that Spalding had practically regular dealings with Rigdon. He saw Rigdon in the Patterson Print Shop. Other people saw Rigdon in the Patterson Print Shop. In fact, I think either Miller or Reddick McKee thought that he was a regular employee of the Patterson Print Shop. So again, more testimony putting Rigdon in Pittsburgh around the time that Spaulding was alive. Ann Treadwell Redfield, her claim to fame is that she spoke a lot with Spaulding's wife, who told her that Rigdon stole the manuscript. This is really fascinating, and it's one of our more recent discoveries. Sidney Rigdon had cousins, just like it says, who lived in Amity, which is Spaulding's last home, 20 years before Spaulding moved there. And we know that Rigdon visited his cousins. In fact, one of them, Mary Rigdon, lived within a stone's throw of the Spaulding home and tavern. So I think it's pretty ludicrous to think that Rigdon never visited or anything like that. Finally, we have Rebecca Eichbaum's testimony. Who was she? She was the wife of the postmaster in Pittsburgh during the years 1811 through 1816. And she gives phenomenal testimony where she names names. I saw the Pattersons, I saw Rigdon, I saw Spaulding. And she tells how often she saw them. She saw Rigdon and his ward Lambden on a regular basis. And in fact, one of their favorite times to pick up their mail was on Sunday afternoons when the post office had to be open. Her testimony has been assaulted over and over and over again. I think Fawn Brody goes after it. Numerous apologists have gone after it. They're all saying, because she didn't deliver her testimony till she was well into her 80s. So the claim was, how can you trust an old person's memories? Well, out comes the Pittsburgh Commonwealth. And in the Pittsburgh Commonwealth, we have the following. A list of letters. If you did not pick up your mail on a timely basis, guess what? You were in the paper, okay? Kind of the early 19th century version of, like I said, you've got mail. And the list would stay in the paper for up to a month. If the letters weren't picked up by then, it went into a dead letter file. Well, let's see if I can get this little guy to work. Right up there. You see it? Solomon Spaulding. I have to apologize for the quality of the photograph. These are made off of quick Xeroxes. We're trying to get some professional photocopies made. But anyway, there's Solomon Spaulding's name. And who should be on the same list? So much for Rebecca Eichbaum having a faulty memory, as well as Miller and McKee and Redfield and the Spauldings, and the list goes on and on and on. And this isn't the only one. Between 1816 and 1818, there are something like 7 or 8 instances of Rigdon having mail waiting for him in the Pittsburgh post office. And what's significant about that is that in those days, mail was delivered to the town where you lived, and if that town did not have a post office, it was delivered to the town that was closest to you. So the question isn't a matter of whether Rigdon lived in Pittsburgh before 1822, it's whether he visited there or not. And clearly, you can see by this, hey, somebody was picking up that mail. Next we have Aaron Wright was a good friend of Solomon Spaulding, and he really got into this thing. This is from an 1830 edition of the Book of Mormon, and you see down here a little comment by him in his best English, and I, A. Wright, does hereby certify that he believes it not. This little number down here, this is actually a certified copy in the Carnegie Library. But he was a little bit skeptical. Okay, support for multiple manuscripts. The reason I showed you Aaron Wright's statement there, he wrote a marvelous letter where he just lays it out chapter and verse. You know, I was with Spaulding often. He read his manuscripts, not manuscript. John Miller's testimony from 1833, which predates Hurlbut visiting him, by the way, so his testimony can't be discounted. He said, I heard, saw, and read Spaulding's manuscripts. Mrs. Spaulding, my husband had multiple manuscripts and stories. Spaulding's daughter, she basically said, Daddy had a lot of different things. He wrote this thing called The Frogs of Wyndham, which is kind of a whimsical poem. And she does a very good description of manuscript found, saying that it was this massive manuscript that was over an inch thick, and it was bound, and on the front cover, it said, manuscript found. Other testimony speaks for itself. I just put that in because I knew we wouldn't be able to get to them all. Also, the physical appearance of manuscript story is so significantly different from all of the verbal descriptions of manuscript found. From the photograph you saw earlier, it was written on paper that was the size of like a standard book, okay? Whereas manuscript found was written on something called fool's cap paper. And some of our critics have said, well, fool's cap is a common term for that day. Well, yes, it was, and no, it wasn't. Fool's cap referred to a certain kind of paper, but it also referred to a very specific size of paper. If you said, I'm going to write you a letter on fool's cap, it means a piece of paper roughly about 12 or 13 by 16 or 18. And we've got numerous testimony from all kinds of periodicals of the day where there are ads for different books and magazines and all that kind of stuff where they say published quarterly in quarto or published recently in octavo to save on paper and printing costs. On the right, you have a half sheet or what is called folio, fool's cap paper. On the left, you have quarto or quarter sheet fool's cap paper. So, I mean, you can see just from here alone, there's a tremendous difference in size. To make it a little bit more obvious, here is what would be, I had to put two folio sheets together to create the full-size sheet. But you can see the tremendous size difference. Now, you folks are seeing these photographs for the first time anybody has seen them outside of the church in over 30 years. The stuff on the right is from the original handwritten printer's copy of the Book of Mormon. Okay. Rigdon, one of his names, one of his nicknames was the Mysterious Stranger. That was how people referred to him before they came to know that it was that his name was Sidney Rigdon. The list is just, you know, it's nuts. Person after person after person after person. I would like to say a little bit about Lorenzo Saunders because his testimony has been attacked so much from so many different sides, but he has some of the most specific details. He nails Rigdon as being with Joseph Smith in March of 1827 and in the fall of 1827. And the way that he qualifies the March or spring of 1827 at the Smith's house is because the Smiths were fully engaged in harvesting maple sugar. And it was a record harvest that year. Saunders' statements, he says, they're fully engaged in it. There were several workers there, and they're working away. And Saunders says he sees this man, a well-dressed man, standing with a group of men, and he asks one of the other people who it is, and they say, that's Sidney Rigdon, the well-dressed man. And I was originally going to put Rigdon, the well-dressed man, up here and do like a ZZ Top thing, but in any case, over and over and over and over again, he brings up the sugar harvest, the group of people, Sidney Rigdon, and he's there with Smith, okay? So we did a lot of digging on our own. We went back into records. We found that there are marvelous agricultural records for things such as sugar maple harvest. And believe me, we've got, I don't know, must be about 300 or 400 pages on it. And we found that in 1827, they had a record sugar maple harvest. It was fluky weather conditions, and so it caused all of the sap to run earlier, and it was, like I said, a record harvest. And so he ties all of that in, and it's a detail that people are either not wanting to confront, or they just don't know about it, or whatever. But that's such a tremendous qualifier, because you can't fake that, okay? It's history. It's there. These other guys, James Gordon Bennett. Now, they go after him because he misspells Rigdon. He spells it Ringdon. Well, folks, we have found other newspaper articles recently where other people have misspelled Ringdon too, but they all nail him as being the Baptist preacher from Ohio. So, you know, how many can there be? Let's skip all the way down to the bottom. Walter Sidney Rigdon. He was Sidney Rigdon's grandson. Okay? He says that it was common knowledge that Rigdon was involved with taking Spaulding's manuscript, getting together with Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery, and turning it into the Book of Mormon. He's been attacked because he's kind of an anomaly. They say, well, he can't possibly be telling the truth because he's the only one who's saying it. Well, it could be that he was the only one who had guts enough to say it. Because we know for a fact that before Rigdon died, he told his wife to burn all of his papers. He was in fear for his life. You know, when Joseph Smith was murdered and there was the big succession fight, and it boiled down to Brigham Young and Sidney Rigdon. Well, Rigdon confronted Brigham Young and threatened to expose his secrets. And Brigham Young looked at him and he said, "You show yours and I'll show mine." And Rigdon basically turned tail, and the rest is history. Okay, the Ohio Observer. This is a fabulous newspaper article. This is proof that Hurlbut did not concoct the whole authorship claims thing. And at the same time, it affirms all of Spaulding's neighbors who said that he was the real author of the Book of Mormon. This guy did his own independent investigation with the Conneaut witnesses 6 months before Hurlbut interviewed them and then later helped Howe produce Mormonism Unveiled. So this testimony predates Mormonism Unveiled and, like I said, Hurlbut's investigation. Okay, what else we have is, and this is really recent stuff. We found a newspaper article again around 1830 or 1831 about a man by the name of George Wilbur. This guy was a school teacher and later on school superintendent in Bainbridge in 1826 through about 1830. He was also a good personal friend of Sidney Rigdon. They had numerous talks about religion and philosophy, education, all kinds of different things. And he also said that Rigdon was a regular preacher in the area until the winter of 1827, when he mysteriously stops preaching and devotes himself almost entirely to writing this extensive narrative, the way Wilbur describes it. Not only that, but he's very secretive about it, because every time George comes over to talk to him about it, Rigdon is very evasive. Then, in the spring of 1828, who does he see visiting Sidney but Joseph Smith, who hangs out with Sidney for a while, and then they disappear off to Pittsburgh for, I think it was like a couple of months. Okay, 1827, 1828. Gee, Rigdon wasn't supposed to know Smith until December of 1830. There's something wrong here. The Mormonism number 4 is yet more testimony that helps to back up Rigdon and Smith in Bainbridge knowing each other at that time. Now, this is really fascinating because I'm sure that those of you, well, there's probably some of you out there in the audience who recognize these characters across the bottom, okay, as being the ones that Martin Harris allegedly showed to Professor Anthon, who at first could not decipher them, and so all the Mormons were excited, and they said, look, this is proof that Reformed Egyptian is real, and da-da-da-da-da. Joseph Smith had apparently found the plates in 1823. Well, earlier in 1823, a gentleman by the name of Stephen Mack was involved with the discovery of something called the Detroit Manuscript, which was discovered somewhere just outside of Detroit, which was this ancient manuscript that nobody could decipher immediately. Well, Stephen Mack got together a group of what they called the learned, who eventually did discover the origin of all of the different characters, and it wound up being kind of a mishmash of 14th century Irish literary code, 16th or some other century dictionary code, early Latin, shorthand, just a real mishmash of stuff. And similar to Manuscript Found and the Book of Mormon, it was about some ancient civilization. So there's some very interesting things here. Well, what makes it even more interesting is that Stephen Mack was Joseph Smith's uncle through the Mack family, okay? And he was also instrumental in getting Martin Harris connected with Anthon to show the characters. Now Mormonism 4 clicks in. There's a man, a very, very brilliant man by the name of Richard Stout, who did a study on the Detroit manuscript. And these, I can tell you right now that these very same characters that also appear in the Detroit manuscript, just in a little bit more organized fashion in the form of real words instead of this mishmash. But it was all the same stuff. And a lot of the storyline of the Detroit manuscript can also be found in the Book of Mormon. Some of the names are similar to names in the Book of Mormon. And more interestingly, there are bizarre animals in this Detroit manuscript, and they're called basically the same names in the Book of Mormon. So right now, this is more of an interesting curiosity than anything else, but I wanted to show you the actual newspaper article identifying or announcing the discovery of the Detroit manuscript. It has been shown that Joseph Smith, the only way that he could have known about something like this is through Stephen Mack. And we know that Stephen Mack was visiting the Smiths all around that time. So it is yet another connection tying the whole thing together to a fictional story or fictional history, if you will. Okay, I told you earlier in the lecture we had other copies of Rigdon in Pittsburgh. Well, these are, I'm sorry, very poor quality blow-ups, but these are the other instances when Rigdon was too lazy to pick up his mail, and so they said, come get your mail. These are more of the handwritten printer's copy of the Book of Mormon. And I brought this along to show you folks just, you know, as a historical item. I thought you might find it interesting. And I was not kidding earlier when I said that you folks are probably the first people outside the church to see these in over 30 years, because we have it on good authority that only but the most faithful these days, actually since the late 70s, are allowed to see these. Okay, more, yet more pages from the Spalding manuscript. You can kind of tell, I mean, the guy was just not in the best of health, even when he was writing this. And we actually had an handwriting analyst look at this, and without telling him a word about Spalding, he said, was this guy suffering from some disease or something or other at the time? And it just amazed us how he could tell that from the writing. But okay, here's the Rogues Gallery. Going from left to right, Howard Davis, the man who first mentioned Spalding to me, yours truly holding the book. Wayne Cowdery, he is a relative of Oliver Cowdery, not a descendant. There are claims all over the internet that Wayne has claimed to be a descendant of Oliver Cowdery, and he never said it. They share a common Oliver's grandfather is Wayne's, I don't know, great-great or something like that, grandfather. The guy on the right is our book's editor, Bill Moore. He took all of the research ramblings that Wayne, Howard, and I had amassed, and believe me, it goes in excess of something like 10,000 pages that we have put together just since 1993 on this, not to mention all the other stuff between 74 and 93. The man is amazing, and he turned our book into what it is, and we owe him a big debt of gratitude. And here's the trio spanning the 30 years. I don't know, maybe some of you out in the audience recognize the book on the left. That was our first attempt, and it was kind of a runaway bestseller, thank God. And it really helped to revitalize the Spalding authorship claims. The square item in the middle was a CD version that we came out with in 2000, and the reason that we put it on a CD is because it was over 1,100 pages long, and we knew that nobody was going to print that. And finally, who really wrote the Book of Mormon, which came out in 2005. And even that manuscript, when we turned it in, was over 800 pages. It is now a mere afternoon's reading of 560 pages. It's a methodical, historical expose of what I have just been spending these last minutes telling you about. There's no religious controversy in there other than the fact that our book is a historical book about a religious book. But we went that path on purpose so that we could at least diminish somewhat the claims that we just have a religious axe to grind or something like that. So that's basically the end of my talk, and you know, I was in such a dither about coming up here that I forgot to bring printed materials or any books. So I'll just leave this up here while any of you want to ask any questions, and you can reach me. I'll be here for the whole weekend. I think we have a flight out tomorrow late afternoon or something like that. I brought one copy of our book. I also brought an 83-page rebuttal of a book review that Farms did. We are flattered all to pieces. In August of 2005, they wrote a review, and it wasn't just a review. They devoted 130 pages to our book. They probably could have said it in about five. And like somebody said, I think, last night during the open mic thing or even during the video earlier today, it was just a rehash and rehash and rehash going all the way back to 1840 with Benjamin Winchester. What can I say? So anyway, if any of you have any questions, I'll be... Yes?
If Rigdon was brave enough to steal the manuscript, Why did he need Joseph and Oliver Cowdery to produce this scene? Why didn't he want to take the authorship, the credit?
I don't think he really had the skills to develop it into the Book of Mormon. He was a skilled clergyman. He was a fiery preacher. In fact, we have accounts of him getting so worked up over some of his sermons that he literally frothed at the mouth. But he was also mentally unstable, and I don't mean that as a slight. When he was around 12 years old, he had a horseback riding accident where he fell off the horse with one of his feet stuck in the stirrup and was dragged along for some period of time before he finally got loose. We don't have all of the answers. I would love to give you a very concise, specific answer as to why he did what he did. Like us, he had to work his day job in order to further his other things along. He was busy as a preacher. It's just been our contention that it took a while for these guys to get together and form the partnership, bringing all the necessary elements together, because Rigdon did not have the salesmanship. Smith did. Smith didn't have the theological knowledge. Rigdon did. Neither one of them knew the first thing about printing, but Oliver did. And so then it took the three of them coming together to make it a reality. Yes?
Was Solomon Spaulding as illiterate as Joseph Smith appears to be in the first version of the Book of Mormon, with his many grammatical mistakes and common expressions? Wouldn't Solomon Spaulding have been more highly educated, more able to write? First question. The second question is, what specific parallels or text can you connect to the actual Book of Mormon text and Spaulding's text? I mean, I'm sure there's big differences between Spaulding's original manuscript and what's in the Book of Mormon. What's the means of transmission from one to the other?
Well, I don't have all of that information, but I can tell you that the Conneaut witnesses, people who all knew Spaulding very well, identified the Book of Mormon from the very first time that it was preached from a pulpit. And when they were later interviewed by Hurlbut, they mentioned specific names: Lehi, Nephi, the Lamanites. They mentioned the storyline. That's all that I can really give you, but it was identified very, very specifically. In fact, when Orson Hyde was preaching in Amity for the very first time, he didn't get very far through his first sermon when an old gentleman got up in the back and he said, "Old Come to Pass is back among us." Now, if it's so radically different, how would this person know? And this man was a very respected man in the community. He was a judge. I think he went on to be a state senator. Very good reputation. And he nailed it right on the spot. And it so unnerved Hyde that neither he nor any other Mormons visited that town for 30 years. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, I just recently have read the 175 Oberlin College account, and what do we know about manuscript found, which for my I'm getting is would be much more closer to the Book of Mormon if we had an account of it. What's in there that's not in the story? Do we have any evidence of anything that differences?
All we have is the witness testimony relating to it, because just like those golden plates that nobody seems to have really seen with physical eyes, manuscript found disappeared. However, we do have some very good speculations on where some copies may still exist. And so we're checking that out, as well as the missing 116 pages, by the way. But to answer your question a little bit more, all we really have are the witnesses' testimonies, and there are, dozens of them, all describing manuscript found. And, interestingly enough, there are many parallels even between manuscript story and the Book of Mormon. And in a very well publicized excommunication trial that Wayne Cowdery went through. Well, he's not up there now. That Wayne Cowdery went through in, I believe, 1976. He was confronted by one of the Mormon trial lawyers who made the statement that there is not one parallel between manuscript story and the Book of Mormon. And Wayne got up, nose to nose with this guy, and he said, "You're right, there's not one, there are hundreds. And if you're willing to look at it with an open mind, no biases, you will find them. And we have records of them. People besides us have gone on and they have spent decades compiling the parallels between even manuscript story and the Book of Mormon."
With all your research on Solomon Spaulding, how do you deal with the Evan Smith claim from the 18th century?
You mean Ethan Smith, View of the Hebrews?
Ethan Smith. How do you juxtapose the two?
Okay, that's the beauty about this whole thing. I mean, we are not by any means trying to say that it's our theory or nothing. The reason we call our book The Spaulding Enigma is because it is just that. There's plenty of room for Ethan Smith's view of the Hebrews to have been an influence, and in fact, there are people like Dale Broadhurst and Craig Criddle, I believe, and some others who are looking into that, and we've got no problem with that whatsoever. The thing is, Ethan Smith wrote his view of the Hebrews from a completely different standpoint than Spaulding wrote either manuscript story or manuscript found. Plus, to give a little bit more weight and credence to Solomon Spaulding, his text was not original. He ripped off somebody before him. There's a book by a historian named James Adair who wrote A History of the American Indians. There's no coincidence that he used this as his subject. It was one of the most widely held beliefs going to well before the Revolutionary War and persisting on through, I think, the mid or late 1800s till more scientific studies could be conducted, that the American Indians were in fact descended from the Lost Tribes. And that's James Adair's premise in his book. Not only that, but he mentions the Urim and the Thummim and a breastplate and epic battles and all that kind of stuff. And so Spaulding just freely borrowed from him. And then Rigdon, Cowdery, and Smith just freely borrowed from them. Not only that, but Solomon Spaulding and Ethan Smith, their time at Dartmouth overlapped. Okay, so they could have been colleagues. So yeah, there's plenty of room for that. There was somebody in the
right here.
Oh, okay.
I'm wondering about the veracity of the witnesses talking about the translation process with Joseph Smith looking at his seer stone in the hat. I mean, either Joseph Smith is reading the manuscripts and then concocting a tale in his head. You know, you have his mother giving evidence that he would regale them with fanciful stories of ancient American civilization and that.
I have the testimony for you. The part where he was reading from the hat, that was actually in respect to the entire time that the translation process was going on. It was fairly short. Much more of the translation was going on with Smith behind the curtain, kind of like the Wizard of Oz, you know, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. And there are numerous witness testimonies who attest to Smith's extremely good memory. So for Harris's benefit, because Harris was an admitted believer in angels and things miraculous and things like that, Joseph Smith could have been, we believe, was doing that all for his benefit to get his money to pay for the printing of the book. See, here we have the problem of getting the funds to pay for the book again.
Yeah, my point is I don't think that witness about the 40-day time span and that is actually reliable. I do not believe that.
Well, right, and we don't believe that that incredibly brief time period, the whole thing, nobody could have handwritten, what is it, over 600 pages in that time? you know, unless they were riding around the clock and had, you know, probably a dozen people riding. Goes back to, pardon me?
Inspired by God, he said.
Well, there you go. But, yeah. I mean, look at the writing utensils of the time. How fast are they going to go? Any other questions?
With regard to that testimony, I believe Emma Smith was part of it that was amazed at how Joseph could dictate so fluently. I kind of discount Emma Smith's testimony. She also testified that Joseph never participated in polygamy.
Well, there you go. My wife just reminded me of a little interesting aside. Our co-author, Wayne Cowdery, has been watching the Internet. Thank God for the Internet. He's been watching the Internet, specifically at online bookstores like Amazon.com and other places. And in the last week, our book has, it's number one with a bullet. this last Monday, it was number five, with 1 through 4 all being either the Book of Mormon or right. It was a very narrow category of Mormonism and on the Book of Mormon, and I don't know why they would call it this, controversial books on Mormonism. On Monday, it started out at number 5, with 1 through 4 either being the Book of Mormon or commentaries on it. The next day, it went up to number 4, and then Thursday morning, number 1, with number 2... Now, you know, all things are relative. I think it was based on, you know, a survey of like 100 books or something like that. But still, there's some sort of a groundswell, or so it would seem. People are coming out and acknowledging and contributing to the research. The more recent discoveries that I discussed toward the end of the show... are just the tip of the iceberg. There are some things that we are working on right now that I really can't talk about because they're still kind of tentative, but it's coming. It's coming. And thanks to a lot of you who are helping to make it possible. Yes.
Hold on.
Sorry.
Thanks. At what point in time was it a transformation, or you see a transformation from it being a money-making scheme to sell a book and becoming a church and organization? Was it an idea to have a church from the start, or when did that happen?
I am so glad you asked that, because it was Smith's ultimate money-making scheme. He didn't have a church in mind. Rigdon did, okay? And Rigdon somehow thought that once Smith and Cowdery made the book a reality, he was going to come in as the head of this new church and be the prophet. He didn't reckon with Smith, okay? Smith just, as soon as the book came out, but it wasn't even Smith's idea. Some people said, hey, Joe, this would make a great religion. And not only that, but if you look at the very first meeting, what is it, 55 out of the 63 people who attended that first conference or whatever it was, they were all related. They were all related. What's with that, you know? So, you know, and it's been claimed that, you know, the pro-Spalding witnesses were biased of one sort or another. Gee, I don't think any of the witnesses in favor of Smith were biased, do you? Any other questions? But yeah, we thought originally that the church was the first thing, and through further research we found that the first idea was money making, and it really made sense. And by the way, some of our best information came from Mormon sources, so it just we had to peel back several layers. We had to get down into this enough. And for those of you who want a really, really good single resource on Mormonism, it is the New Mormon Studies CD-ROM. It's tremendous. Now, you might have to go to eBay or something like that. Signature Books published it for a while, and then it wasn't available, or the company that actually produced it was bought by somebody else. I know that seems a little unusual, but anyway, it is excellent. It is really, really excellent. It goes into, like, the occult influences, like Lumen Walters talking to Joseph Smith, and also the fact that Joseph Smith wasn't the first choice for prophet. It was Alvin Smith. Alvin, who died from eating some mushrooms as a treatment for some disease or something or other. Yes, I'm sorry.
You talk about how these authors borrowed from other authors everybody stole from everybody to get these, to come up with the Book of Mormon. How about, have you looked into, and how much have you looked into the theft of the temple ceremonies from the Masons and other, and then the, any other of the occult?
How much time do you have?
because it doesn't seem like he quit, he didn't quit, seemed like he didn't quit stealing. You know, and borrowing ideas and incorporating, it seemed like it kept going, you know,
okay,
until Brigham Young.
Think about this. Several of the Smiths were Mormon. They were Mormons, yeah. They were Masons before they were Mormons. And then the anti-Masonic thing happened, started by this Captain William Morgan. We have some evidence which links Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery to at least the kidnapping of Captain Morgan. We don't think that they had anything to do with the death. But when that anti-Masonic fervor just rose to a real peak to where there were almost witch hunts, all of these guys just, no, I'm not a Mason, no, not me. And then later on, they became Masons again, and not just rank-and-file Masons, you know, what, 33rd degree and Temple Arch and this and that. We have hundreds and hundreds of pages of research documenting the different Masonic Lodge memberships that these people had. Yeah, for anybody to deny that there are Masonic influences in Mormonism, what are you, brain dead? I mean, you know, I hate to be abrupt like that, but any other questions?
Time for one more, probably.
I'll be here all weekend. Try the beef. I don't see anybody else, so I guess oh, wait a minute. I got somebody in the back. In the cheap seats. Actually, there are no cheap seats here. They're all good seats.
I did read the book about a year ago.
Thank you.
It was fabulous. It is a page-turner, so it is long, but it's hard to put down when you're exiting Mormonism. So,
well, thank you so much.
A couple of things. First of all, Lucinda Pendleton, I believe Morgan Pendleton, et cetera, Joseph Smith did end up marrying Captain Morgan's widow.
Yeah, as did Brigham Young. And, I mean, by the time she was done marrying into the Mormon hierarchy, she had, what, five or six different last names? And they treated her like a princess.
Yes, well, how to tie that together, I don't know. But I don't think there's enough string to tie it all together,
well,
frankly. So
actually, there is another interesting tie-in with that, because again, this is a little bit on the tentative side, but we believe that Oliver Cowdery actually may have either offered to help print or helped print Morgan's treatise on Freemasonry. So there are some very interesting tie-ins on the whole thing.
The thing that occurs to me that I read your book and I found it compelling, to say the least. I have a hard time understanding the reticence of both Fawn Brody and people like Grant Palmer or they're quick to discount this connection, even with all of the information, for example, that's in your book. I guess I'm not asking you to answer why, because you can't get in their head, but would you have a comment about that?
Well, you know, when Fawn Brody started writing her book, she was a good and faithful Mormon. And it wasn't until her journey of discovery, which resulted in her book, that she eventually did get excommunicated. And it's very interesting, the Mormon relationship with Fawn Brody, because when she serves their purposes, they all hide behind her skirts. But yet when somebody else, like even we use Fawn Brody a few times, then, oh no, she was an apostate, she was excommunicated, just like with Hurlbut, you know. Is it a quick question? Because I guess my time is basically out. Well, okay, I can answer this in 30 seconds. Okay. Basically, don't they try to demonize whoever it is who criticizes the church? And I'm sure none of you have had that happen to you. But Hurlbut, who was the first, what a name to have. His full name was Dr. Philastus Hurlbut. His first name was Doctor, okay? And the Mormons, not content to hammer him with immorality and all this other kind of stuff, some of them even went so far as to claim that he tried to trade off of his first name. Well, believe me, we've done extensive research on this, and he never did. But you go down the line, even up through and including Simon Southerton and the marvelous work that he did. What do they do? Well, you guys know. But the coup de grace was when he went back to Australia and they quietly excommunicate him on grounds of immorality, claiming that he had an affair with his wife. Well, they're happily married. He knew why they were really doing it. You all know why they did it to him, because he was right. Thank you so much.
That was fabulous. Thank you so much. We're going to have a little short break, but I wanted to tell you, Brian Patrick has left, but he did leave five more of the DVDs. If anybody did want one, I have those, and you can come to me directly. They are $25. Do you want one back there? Okay. Anyway, just find me, and I'll take a check, and then I'll forward it on to him. We're going to have a really, really interesting panel here in just a few minutes. And unless you really, really need to go out, I'd like to start that one as soon as we can. So let's take a very short break and be back at the most in 10 minutes, please.
I'll leave it up to you whether you want to announce it or not. If people want to order books, that was one of the reasons why I put my contact information up for a while.
Yeah.
If they want, they can get an autographed copy from me.
I guess we never talked.
Well, you mentioned it to me and discussed shipping it up. I was just...